Welcome back to the Rambam's Shmona Prakim, and here we are in the final chapter. Now, it's not our final session together. The eighth chapter is a little bit long, so it'll take us at least two sessions, and I hope that it'll only take us two sessions because we only have two classes left in the series this week and next, and I hope that we will be able to finish the Shmona Prakim, even if we have to cheat a little bit, as you'll see, as we move along. After seven chapters discussing man's task in the world and a conception of the Adam HaShalem, the Rambam's idea for what human perfection looks like and laying out a roadmap for how to get there and the kind of what I cheekily called the kind of maintenance work, car maintenance. It wasn't. Somebody asked me if I was trying to make a reference to that book, you know, about the Zen and motorcycle repair, which in my great Amharatsus, must confess, I've never read. I wasn't actually trying to make that reference, although you can say that there are some connections. All of these topics that the Rambam has undertaken. The laying out the image of the middle road, the Shvil HaZahav, the path of moderation in developing balance in one's midot or deot, one's personality traits as a prerequisite for developing one's religious, spiritual, intellectual personality. Now we get to the final chapter, which is nothing more, nothing less than a description of teva enoshi, human nature. It's conceivable that the Rambam might have constructed the work that the final chapter, or at least the bulk of it, would have come at the beginning of the work. Somebody could imagine a parallel universe in which the Rambam would have structured it that way. The fact that he chooses to place it at the end is interesting, and perhaps as we move along, we might wonder why the Rambam chose to conclude the work with at least much of many of the topics he discusses here. Some of the topics that the Rambam undertakes in this last chapter are bread and butter ideas, Maimonidean ideas, elements in the Rambam's thought, which he of course visited elsewhere, including in the Mishneh Torah, in the Sefer Mada, as well as in the Mor Nevuchim, subsequently the Mor Nevuchim. This, of course, is the Rambam's earliest iteration of some of these ideas, this work having been authored first, as I've mentioned a few times. The Rambam starts off by saying, Lo yitachen, it is inconceivable, sheyeh ha'adam b'teva mitchilat b'riyato, is inconceivable that a man or woman should be, by nature, from the beginning of their path, from the beginning of their existence, bal ma'ala velo bal chisaron. No one starts off as being virtuous or flawed. It doesn't work that way. Kemo shelo yitachen, sheyeh ha'adam b'teva bal melacha min hamelachot ha'ma'asiyot. Just as no one is born a carpenter, just as no one is born an orthodontist, just as no one is born a house painter, so too no one is born good or bad, virtuous or vice-ridden. Aval yitachen sheyeh b'teva muchan el ma'ala o el p'chitut. That doesn't mean that you aren't born with certain dispositions. I'm going to now, just so that we can make some miles, I'm going to turn now for part of our discussion to the English translation, because it will help us move faster. I've made it a point, even a point of pride, as well as a pedagogical point, that throughout our study together, that we were reading from the Hebrew edition of the Rambam's Shmona Prakim that was translated by Rav Shilat from Male Adumim here in Israel. Of course, I've mentioned a number of times this work, like every other work the Rambam wrote, aside from the Mishneh Torah, this work was authored in Arabic or in Judeo-Arabic and translated in the Rambam's own lifetime to Hebrew. The Rambam wrote in the lingua franca of his community, not in Hebrew, except for, of course, the magnum opus, the Mishneh Torah. And actually, Barbara makes mention of something that we discussed in the Agnon sessions. Agnon makes reference to this fact in his story Chush HaReach, where he admits that certain classical works were not written in Hebrew, and he gives a justification for that. So you can look there in that story. In English, it's called A Sense of Smell. But this translation, which I think we have uploaded to the Shir homepage, is this translation. The whole thing is available from Google Books. It's an early 20th century translation. I'm forgetting who did the translation. The name's escaping me. But it's in the public domain, and the whole thing is available on Google Books. And again, also from the front page of our Shir homepage. So by birth, no one is destined to be one thing or another. That doesn't mean that you don't have a predilection for one thing or another. For instance, a man whose natural constitution inclines towards dryness. Now here he gives a description of the humors, which we refer to not as actual bodily fluids, but as different personality traits. So if we were to translate it to the modern metaphor, instead of talking about dryness and phlegm and etc., to say that there are certain people who appear to be naturally inclined towards anger, or naturally inclined towards leitzonus, towards a kind of jocularity, a kind of not taking anything seriously, or any other personality trait for that matter. But that doesn't mean that they're predestined to be that way. It doesn't mean that they're predestined to be that way. Why? Because, and the Rambam says, I make mention of this, so that you shouldn't believe the absurd ideas of astrologers. And here the Rambam goes off on a discussion of an attack on astrology. The astrologers who falsely assert that the constellation at the time of one's birth determines whether one is to be virtuous or vicious. Vicious meaning not in the general sense of vicious, but vicious in the sense of vice. The individual being thus necessarily compelled to follow out a certain line of conduct. We, on the contrary, are convinced that our law, that the Torah, agrees with Greek philosophy, which substantiates with convincing proofs the contention that man's conduct is entirely in his own hands, that no compulsion is exerted, and that no external influence is brought to bear upon him that constrains him to be either virtuous or vicious, vice-ridden, except inasmuch as, according to what we have said above, he may be by nature so constituted as to find it hard or easy, easy or hard, as the case may be, to do a certain thing, but that he must necessarily do or refrain from doing a certain thing is absolutely untrue. So the idea that astrology teaches that if you're born under such and such a sign, in such when this star is in that house or whatever it is, that is an entirely un-Jewish idea, the idea that any of these things influence us. Completely by coincidence, I was just discussing this with my son. It's true that Chazal, that the Gemara, that the Midrash, make reference to the zodiacs. That right now in Adar we are in what's called Mazal Dagim, the star of the fishes, the Pisces. And that idea exists, you can find in old Jewish calendars or machzorim, even the signs of the zodiac. There are, for example, there are piyutim, medieval religious poetry, or kinot, you know, like the kinds of liturgical poems that we say on Tisha B'Av, that'll go through the cycle of the year using the metaphors or using the symbols of the zodiac. Those are merely reference points for the months. But the Rambam completely rejects the idea that the zodiac or that astrology has any effect on one's personality. Stacy asked, is the Rambam saying that choice trumps predetermination of astrology? It doesn't trump. They're not in competition. One is true and one is false. One is the way things are, and the other is a complete bava misa. The Rambam says the idea that when you are born or the stars that affect you determine that you will be this way or you will be that way is completely not true. And although everybody, obviously, we're not completely behavioralists, we're not completely Skinnerites, we do believe that there is human nature, and we do believe that certain people have a predilection for one thing and other people have a predilection for something else. But that doesn't negate free choice. That doesn't negate free choice. Why is the Rambam so insistent on this point? Does anyone have any thoughts on that matter? And why the Rambam feels so strongly about this, not just here, but elsewhere? Curious if you have any thoughts on that. Anyone? It's true that astrology is possible to be consuming, but I think Stuart's right. It has to do with the Rambam's very, very strong emphasis on the role of free will in life, in religious life, and astrology flies in the face of that. For the Rambam, free will is a cornerstone of the Jewish worldview. So much so that there's a question. You know, and we've discussed it in past semesters, about a year ago probably, when we were studying a different part of the Rambam, where the Rambam discusses the principles of faith, the Yud Gimel Ikare Emuna, the 13 principles of faith, which we know in their summarized form, the Ani Mamins, maybe the most famous one because it's set to music, Ani Mamin Bemuna Shelema Beviat HaMashiach. We believe with complete faith in the coming of the Messiah. And even though he isn't yet here, even though he seems to be taking his time, nevertheless, we believe with complete faith that either that he'll come every day or that every day he could come. I'll look at the chat in a second. Let me just finish this thought. But it's interesting, the Rambam does not mention free will, belief in free will, as one of the 13 principles of faith. And this is a serious question. Why does the Rambam, who obviously feels so strongly about it, why doesn't he believe that subscribing to the notion of free will is one of the 13 principles of faith? So it's possible that it's built into the system, that you don't need to make it explicit because for the Rambam, belief in free will is everything else is predicated on that. The idea that there's reward and punishment. And he actually basically says this in Hilchot Tshuva, the Laws of Repentance. Belief in reward and punishment is one of the 13 principles of faith. It would be completely illogical to posit that reward and punishment, belief in reward and punishment, as the principles of faith, if we were living in a world without free will. In a world without free will, reward and punishment are meaningless. They can't exist. You can't have reward and punishment in a world without free will, because what is there to reward and what is there to punish? I'm just looking at the chats. Barbara mentions this idea that we're above the stars, or Ein Mazal Yisrael, which here the Rambam seems to be saying, yes, precisely, that's the idea, that the notion of the stars, the zodiac, does not apply to us. I think that by using free will rather than astrology, one works together with God in creation, whereas astrology creation works upon the person. I think Stacy's correct in that. Our free will is limited. Barbara, what do you mean by that? Our free will is limited. To choose between good and evil. I'm not sure I understand what you're saying. In what way is it limited? In what way is the free will limited? No, that's not true. We have free will. We can not just moral and ethical decisions, but life choices and how we form ourselves and what influences we allow to impact on us. You're unmuted, Barbara. If you want, you can speak. Okay, look, I don't want to speak about that specific story of this particular friend of yours. And although we you don't get arrested. You also don't get drafted to the army. again, without speaking about specific cases of specific people and unusual things that happen in life. And while clearly we do believe, and this is also one of the Rambam's principles of faith, that there is such a thing as hashgacha pratit, that God is involved in our lives, that doesn't mean that every choice that we make is the choice that God would have made for us. We have free will, and we have free will in order to make mistakes. And we're accountable for our mistakes, and we're accountable for our sins, and we're called to judgment on them, which means that if we were to ask God before we do mistake X or sin Y, should we do this? If we had access to his direct answer instead of, you know, a kind of intuitive knowledge of what he wants from us, we would know that he doesn't want us to do that. We would know that's not what we're supposed to do, and yet we have choice to do it anyway. If we make those mistakes, we're accountable in whatever way he holds us accountable, or in whatever way society holds us accountable. So I'm not sure that it that's a limit, and I don't think that I agree. I mean, I don't think the Rambam would agree with what you say in terms of this kind of notion that everything works out according to some divine plan. Well, maybe that's true in the global picture, but in our day-to-day, moment-to-moment decisions, we each have free choice, including the choice to make mistakes. Now, that doesn't mean that he doesn't have another way to, work it out, that history unfolds in the way that he wants it to. But I mean, think about all different types of things. That, on the contrary, there's a very dangerous consequence of adopting, the full extent of that position that everything that happens is what God wants to happen, because that means in the face of evil or in the face of suffering, somebody that were to say, well, obviously those people are suffering because that's God's will, that's what God wants, that is very spiritually distracting, because it deludes us into thinking that, well, if that's what God wanted, so then we have no role in trying to alleviate that. So I'm not sure that, that's a kind of healthy way to look at it. Let me just look at what's been going on in the chat here. Okay, say that's what I said. Shaul knew that what God wanted regarding the Amalekites, but he did not kill Agag, so there is free will and Shaul suffered the consequences. Yes, that's a very good example. That's a very good example. Okay, I'm not sure if we're agreeing or disagreeing, but I'm trying to put forth what I think the Rambam is saying, which again, as I pointed out many times, is not the only way of looking at some of these philosophical, theological points of view, but it's hard to get around the Rambam. He goes on, were a man compelled to act according to the dictates of predestination, then the commands and prohibitions of the Lord become null and void. The idea of Torah u'mitzvot, that there are commandments, that there are things that we should do and things that we shouldn't do, only makes sense in a world with free will. And the law would be completely false, since man would have no freedom of choice in what he does. Moreover, it would be useless, in fact, absolutely in vain, for man to study, to instruct, or attempt to learn an art, or a craft, or a profession, as it would be entirely impossible for him, on account of the eternal external forces compelling him, according to the opinion of those who hold this view, to keep from doing a certain act, from gaining certain knowledge, or from acquiring a certain characteristic. Reward and punishment, too, would be pure injustice, both as regards man towards man and between God and man. Suppose under such conditions that Shimon would kill Reuven. Why should Shimon be punished, seeing that he was predetermined, he was constrained to do the killing, and Reuven was predestined to be slain? How could the Almighty, who is just and righteous, chastise Shimon for a deed which was impossible for him to have to leave undone? Meaning, if it was predetermined that this would happen, so then what would be the point of punishing someone? If such were the true state of affairs, all precautionary measures, such as building houses, providing means of subsistence, fleeing when fears danger, and so forth, would be absolutely useless, for that which is decreed beforehand must necessarily happen. This theory is therefore positively unsound, contrary to reason and common sense, subversive of the fundamental principles of religion, the attributes, and attributes injustice to God. Because if that were the case, if it were true that everything is predetermined, that my choices are all made for me, but yet I'm held accountable for those choices, so then That would mean God is a wicked God. Why would he punish me for doing something that I had no control over? In reality, the undoubted truth of the matter is that man has full sway over all of his actions. If he wishes to do a thing, he does it. If he does not wish to do it, he need not, without any external compulsion controlling him. That doesn't mean, the Rambam's not saying that there isn't such a thing as social compulsions, that there isn't such a thing as peer pressure. Obviously, these things do exist, but he means predetermination. Nothing is a foregone conclusion, and we have the ability to make those determinations for ourselves. Let me just look here at the chat. Oh, good. I appreciate the fact that so many of you have your cameras on. I've been harping about that for a couple of weeks already. And therefore, that's what this notion that we have, b'charta b'chayim, right? That God lays out paths for us. He lays out choices, and ultimately the choices are up to us. And therefore, that's what reward and punishment is about. And furthermore, learning and teaching are also necessary. And here's a very important point, a point which he, in some ways, he makes more sharply here than he does even in the Mishneh Torah, even in the later work. Since our choices are up to us, that frames the role of Talmud Torah in a different light, both as a pragmatic matter as well as a theological matter. The necessity of Talmud Torah, the necessity of study, the role of Torah study in our life, beyond being a normative mitzvah which is weighed against the gravity and the significance of all other mitzvot put together for certain purposes. Engaging in Talmud Torah is necessary precisely because we're responsible for our own actions. Or in the words of, you know, kind of general civil society, ignorance of the law is no defense. Since we are held accountable for our actions, it's our obligation to study. It's our obligation to study because since we're obligated to whatever it is, to keep Shabbat. Since we're obligated to keep Shabbat, and Shabbat is something which is complicated. It's complicated in all times, and it gets more and more complicated as the generations go on because the applications become ever more complex. So therefore, you have to learn. You have to know how to keep Shabbat. If this is a topic that interests you, look at the introduction of the Mishnah Brura in Hilchot Shabbat, an idea that he also talks about in the general introduction about, you know, the necessity to study, and that if you'll merely study, if you'll merely learn the laws, everybody wants to do the right thing. The Mishnah Brura was perhaps operating under a certain social reality, which we are not always privileged to benefit from. But the idea that, you know, if you're committed to doing the right thing, so good intentions are not enough. We require a very high level of knowledge, of mastery of details, of literacy. So that's on the plane of simple halacha lamaaseh. But not only that. Torah study is also about knowing being able to make applications of principles to life decisions. Particularly take the realm of Bein Adam L'Chaveiro. If you want to know the halachot of, I don't know, let's say tefillin. Tefillin is a rather complicated set of halachot, but once you've mastered it, and assuming that your tefillin are kosher and nothing's befallen them to render them unkosher, once you've mastered the basic technique of fastening tefillin onto arm and to head, you have it. And the performance of the mitzvah today is the same as it will be tomorrow, is the same as it was yesterday. The variables are all the same. But in the realm of Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, interpersonal interactions, there are always, in every interaction, at least two variables of almost infinite variability. And you end up multiplying near infinity with near infinity. And those are the variables of you and I. Because all Bein Adam L'Chaveiro interaction involve me interacting with you. So that Biker Cholim, if I want to visit the sick, is not going to be the same if I'm visiting Reuven as when the next day I visit Shimon. Because Reuven and Shimon, not only do they maybe suffer from different diseases, but imagine that their medical records were identical. But Reuven and Shimon aren't identical. And the needs of one, and the emotions of one, and the mindset of one, and what's going to bring comfort to one, are going to be different than all of those things for the second person. Think about Shiva. Have you ever gone? You know, it's a crazy thing. My wife and I were just talking about this. You know, we'll go through a period. You know, where in 1 month we'll have 9 bar mitzvahs, and the next month we'll have 5 bris milas. So right now, Rachmana Litzlan, unfortunately, we're in a bad way, and we've been going, you know, every week to one or two Shiva calls. You know, you go through these periods. It never rains, but it pours. To say nothing of the tragedies, you know, on the national plane of what happened last Shabbat. But no two Shiva, you ever go to a Shiva? No two Shivas are the same. No two Shivas are exactly the same. And not just because one person dies at a ripe old age, and another person dies tragically young, and not because one person suffered, and another person, left this world with a minimum of suffering. But it's never the same because the people aren't the same. And to know what to do and to know how to comfort and to know how to engage in those kinds of mitzvot are always very complex. It's not like tefillin. I'm not belittling the importance, gravity, or majesty of the mitzvah of tefillin. But again, the technique of the mitzvah is the same as today as it was yesterday. My tefillin don't change. But every human interaction, it's literally the case of you can never step into the same river twice. Because there's so many things in flux and flow. And Torah study in terms of refining your midot and developing the sensitivities, the halachic sensitivities. What Rabbi Twersky, Zichrono Levracha, what Rabbi Yitzchak Twersky, Zichrono Levracha, called, you know, the kind of antenna, the halachic antenna that you have to develop in order to enter a situation and you have to like take this radar, this reading, this map, this X-ray of what's happening in order to make the applications of first principles to each setting. So that's why Torah study is essential for these two: one for a pragmatic, practical, and the other for a more sensitizing, the sensitizing role, the purifying role of Torah study become essential because we are held accountable for our actions. Since we are held accountable for our actions, so it's our responsibility to engage in Torah study because it will provide us with these two reservoirs of, not, on one plane, knowledge, and on the other plane, a sensitivity to knowing what's right, what's wrong, to making the applications of the abstract principles into the actual world. Yeah, Stacey, I think that the case of parent of the case of child parent interaction is certainly true here, and is a good example. Learning and teaching are also necessary according to the commands. You shall teach them to your children, and you shall do them and observe them. And similarly, all the other passages referring to the study of commandments. It's also necessary to take all the precautionary measures laid down in the law, such as thou shalt make a bow on the roof, etc. All of the halachot that you need to do, which prevent you from sin. The statement found in the sayings of the rabbis in Pirkei Avot, Hakol tsafui, hakol bidei shemayim chutz miyirat shemayim, that all is in the power of God except the fear of God, is nevertheless true. That there are certain things that even God, of his own free will, chooses, that there are certain things that are up to us. And yirat shemayim, the fear of God, which he could create. He could have created us to be like the angels. And this is a theme that we've talked about a number of times in a number of different ways over the course of the series, that we're this paradoxical creature. We are like angels and we are like beasts. And we're this strange hybrid of the two. But we could have been like the angels. And of course, we know that very well-known idea from the Gemara, from the Midrash, that the Torah is given to us precisely because we are not angels. The angels who suggested that maybe the Torah should have been given to them, because after all, they're in some ways superior to us. And God's response being that it's irrelevant for angels, because the Torah is a blueprint for reigning in the beast within. And that's irrelevant to the angels. So that the idea that he could have created us with a built-in sense of Yirat Shamayim, instead of fear of heaven, instead of something that we need to work at, is precisely the point. Men are, however, very often prone to err in supposing that many of their actions, in reality, the results of their own free will, are forced upon them, as for instance, marrying a certain woman or acquiring a certain amount of money. Such a supposition is untrue. If a man espouses and marry a woman legally, then she becomes his lawful wife, and by his marrying her, he has fulfilled the divine command to increase and multiply. God, however, does not decree the fulfillment of a commandment. If, on the other hand, a man has consummated with a woman an unlawful marriage, he has committed a transgression. But God does not decree that a man shall sin. Again, suppose, which doesn't mean that we don't have a yetzer. It doesn't mean that we don't feel compulsion. It doesn't mean that we don't have strong drives about this example the Rambam's just described, or any other thing that somebody might have a strong impulse to do. That doesn't mean that you have a strong impulse to something. It doesn't mean that you don't have free will. It means that it's difficult. It means that you must struggle. But God does not decree that a man shall sin. Again, suppose a man robs another of money, steals from him, or cheats him, and then, uttering a false oath, denies it. If we should say that God had destined that this sum should pass into the hands of the one and out of the possession of the other, God would have preordained the act of iniquity. You know, there are all types of Hasidic stories like this, where, you know, kind of like the story Barbara was telling about this friend of hers. You know, we have to wait to hear the end of that story, where, like, you know, in the end, it all works out. It's true that there is such a tradition of looking at things in that way. But that's a tradition that looks ex post facto at a story, whether the story is actually real or is a mashal, a metaphor for something. But that doesn't always mean it's a good way to look at things when you're in the thick of it. Because again, it distracts us from what it is that we ought to be doing. Moreover, to this faculty of the soul, that is, free will, fear of God is subservient and is in consequence not predestined by God. Meaning God does not decree that we should have fear of heaven. God does not decree even that we should believe in him. He could have done that. He could have created us in such a way that it would be inconceivable that people would not believe in God. But that is, in fact, not the case. I'm going to skip ahead to the next paragraph. Wait a second. I'll pause here, and let me just make one reflection about Purim, which we will be celebrating between now and the next time that we meet. This idea that human action is supreme, and that we are masters of our own fate, is echoed very much in the Megillah. Esther is at first hesitant to accept her role on the stage of history. Mordechai's famous, and perhaps it's the highlight of the Megillah, is Revach v'atzala yamdu la Yehudim b'makom acher v'at u'beit avich tovedu. Mordechai says to Esther, listen, God has a way of making things happen the way that they're supposed to happen. That's Barbara's point of view. And you have free will. You can either do what needs to be done or not. Maybe the whole reason the story, the whole Megillah, has unfolded in the way it has up until this perek, up until this chapter. What chapter is that? That's in chapter 4 of the Megillah. Who knows if the whole Megillah hasn't unfolded 4 chapters up until now just to get us to this point. But it doesn't mean that there aren't going to be consequences for you. You may very well perish if you don't need to do what's meant to be done. On the grand scale of history, God's going to have a way of working it out. But that's not to say that you don't have a role. And that's not to say that you can't mess up your role. How God will work things out and what the ultimate result will look like, we don't know. It's like that old... You know, those old I mean, when I was a kid, I don't know if they now they probably have them. They're electronic, I'm sure. But those choose your own ending books, you know, that you were able to read a book and you get to the end of the chapter and there'd be a choice, you know, the Hardy Boys can go this way or they can go that way. And if you want them to go this way, turn to page X. And if you want them to go that way, turn to page Y. And then the book had a way of every time you read it, you could keep walking through a different set of doors to come to different conclusions. However, history unfolds, God has his own way. You have a role to play. There will be consequences for you. That notion of free will versus how things work out is essential, in, not just in the Megillah and in the Rambam, but in our entire way of looking at the world. Now, there is one very significant, sticky, theological, philosophical problem. Among our beliefs is that God is omniscient, that he knows everything. If he knows everything, not just everything that's happening right now, but everything that has happened and will happen, isn't that a contradiction to free will? If God knows what Esther is going to do, since he knows the future, doesn't that mean that she doesn't really have free will? I mean, when we watch a movie that we've seen before, we know what the character is going to do. There's no scenario by which the movie is different the second time we watch it than the first time we watched it. It's the same DVD. A little bit, isn't that the way the world is? If God knows how it's all going to end up, don't we not have free will? Well, obviously I'm setting up a question here to which we're going to have an answer. But this is the very famous Stirat Yedi'ah Uvchira, the contradiction between God's foreknowledge and our free choice. Now, obviously, as Josh has told us, it's not really a contradiction, or the presence of one does not create the absence of the other. But from a philosophical point of view, how does that work? How does God's foreknowledge of everything not mean that there isn't predestination? How does it still allow room for free will? Now that's a complex philosophical question, which the Rambam is aware he has to address. And that and some concluding thoughts to the Shmona Prakim will be the topic when we meet next week, which will be our final session. So we will continue then. I'll stay online if anybody has any questions. And we'll continue then. I had sent an email earlier in the week. I hope you got it. You should have gotten it. This class will continue, or I'll say this classroom will continue next semester after Pesach, meaning I'll continue teaching on Tuesday nights at this time. And I'm open to your suggestions for what we might learn together. For quite a few semesters, we've been learning different topics in the Rambam. I'm open to suggestions for other things to do. Some of you have written in, others haven't. But if you have any thoughts, please email me with ideas or topics or works that you'd like to examine. Something generally in the department of Jewish thought, although it need not be medieval Jewish thought. So I'm happy to get your input on that as we plan out the semester after Pesach. And in the meantime, a Freilich in Purim, a happy Purim to everyone. I hope that you'll all have sobered up by next Tuesday. Laila Tov.